after years on the road, Toomey parked the van and picked up the mic to bring you this podcast that features interviews with people from hardcore to hair metal. This is Talk Toomey with your host, Joshua Toomey.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Talk To Me. This is episode 187.
Don't stop, Mr. 187 on the motherfucking top. TikTok, now what a glock, just some nuts.
The guest this week is Chris Aiken of the Classic Metal Show on to talk about his book, Turbo, in the Cause and Effect series that he does. Great book. I've made it about halfway through the audio book and can't wait to check out the rest of it. It's a lot of fun, about an hour-long conversation with Chris Aiken, because if you guys know Chris from the Classic Metal Show or his appearances on the Talk To Me podcast, you know that man can talk, and we talk a lot. And we talk about, you know, getting autographs from bands, growing up wishing we had cell phone cameras back in the day, talk about his book, talk about, you know, subjects from the Classic Metal Show that you guys might find funny, and so much other stuff. So please stick around for Chris Aiken of the Classic Metal Show. So in honor of having Chris Aiken on the podcast, let's start out the episode this week with some classic metal. Let's do some Skid Row.
Borland from Limp Bizkit, Big Dumb Fish, Black Light Burns, Queen Fong, and you're listening to Talk To Me.
All right, you guys know that the Talk To Me podcast is brought to you each week by Good Company with Bowling. Yes, our good friend Scott Bowling down there in Atlanta, Georgia. Make sure you are checking out his YouTube show, Good Company with Bowling. Just had Jose Mangan on. Looks like his episode with HR from Bad Brains is coming out soon. So make sure you're going over to YouTube, searching out Good Company with Bowling, or checking out scottgoodcompany.com. Let him know that the Talk To Me podcast sent you, and that will be much appreciated. Now it's time for my chat with Chris Akin of the Classic Metal Show.
You are listening to Talk To Me.
Yeah, man, I was going through a bunch of stuff, and I found my Reinventing the Steel backstage pass. I was like, this is a cool piece of memorabilia. I'm going to look it up on eBay just to see. I think it was like $15. I was like, what? That doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
Seems like those things would be a little bit more rare, a little bit more wanted.
Hang on to it for a little while. It will be eventually.
Oh, I wasn't looking to sell. I was just looking to see like if it was... there's a few things I won't get rid of. I got rid of a few things a while back and really regret it. I had a Metallica autographed backstage pass that I sold on eBay for something real cheap, and I'm really regretting it now.
And the crown that I have, the crown jewel that I have, is the I've got Far Beyond Driven signed by all four guys.
Nice.
And I'm like, yeah, I could probably get a good penny for that one.
When I met them, actually same tour, I met them at a hotel and actually just had them sign a white piece of paper. Which
sure.
It's actually one of my framed items on the wall now. But yeah, I've got all four of them, and one of them wrote like 1994 on it. It's pretty cool.
Nice. Yeah, I wish I had more. I wish I would have been more of a collector back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still not, but I wish that I had. I wish we would have had phones because I met everybody, and you know back then I was always like, eh. You know, I would take friends or whatever to shows and they'd all get autographs. And I was always like, you know, I can't be bothered with that shit. Now it's like, God damn it. Now they're starting to die. And I didn't get everybody's signatures and stuff.
Well, I had a friend of mine, Jeremy Owsley, who's actually been on the show a couple times. And he was my like concert going guy. He a couple years older than me, had a car, but he always carried a camera. And if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have anything. And so any photos I have of me and Dimebag or me and Phil or me and anybody from when I was like 13 and 14, it's because he always carried a camera.
Yeah, that's I've met everybody. And I have just a handful of pictures. I have like a picture of me and Dio, picture of me and John Corabi, a picture of me and Dime and Phil. And I don't know that I have many more from the old days. I really never took them. I was always like, most of my time, I was always giving away my passes even.
Yeah.
I would get to a show and I was always like, it's fucking 11 o'clock. It's 40 minutes home. Here, you guys stay for an hour and a half and wait for these guys to shower. I'm leaving.
My thing, too, was I got to a certain point where my bands were kind of starting to take off a little bit, and I was getting a little bit of, like, local notoriety and stuff. And so I didn't want to be a fan anymore. I didn't want to be like, hey, man, can I get your autograph? I wanted to be peers, not necessarily a fan.
Yeah. I went through the same thing. I mean, when the metal show was going, it was fucking massive. And it felt really weird to be like the promoter guy that, you know, like introduced the band on stage and then waited around after to get a signature.
Right.
Felt stupid.
Yeah. So I've got a huge gap in, I don't know when the last thing, I don't honestly know the last autograph I got. I know, man, I think I had I actually had Dime sign my Damage Plan album. I don't know. Like when, wow. Yeah, that was four. Like. Yeah, that would have been 2004. I can't remember. I might have gotten something since then or maybe gotten something for the show or whatnot, but I can't remember my last actual autograph that I said, hey, man, can I get your autograph kind of thing.
Yeah, the only thing that I get, I never get autographs, but the only thing that I have autographed in the last, 6 years since I've been divorced, because that's when I've really gone picture crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Is I took some dildos with me to Steel Panther, and I had those guys sign some fucking dildos.
Nice.
I had them sign them to give them away on the show, and then I just never did. And they're just sitting. They're just sitting there.
And now you have a box of dildos that you can't explain.
I really do. It's like, oh, what is this weird shit?
Well, I'm sure that if people actually make it into your house, they probably expect a box of dildos at some point.
Yeah, exactly. They know what they're walking into.
Yeah. No, I love the cell phone camera, man. I love being able to get a snapshot here and there. And I think most people are used to it by now, but I'm still kind of weirded out about autographs.
Yeah. I just feel like it's dumb asking another another person, hey, will you sign this piece of paper for me so I can keep it forever? I feel like a loser.
Yeah, and actually, you know, it's funny, as I went a couple of weeks ago, a buddy of mine went up to Indianapolis for the Titans-Colts game, which we're not going to talk about the outcome of that. But before the game, he bought like these crazy seats. We were like seventh row, and the Titans were warming up right in front of us, you know. And I root, I'm as, you know, diehard as they come when it comes to the Titans, sure, as you are with the Browns. But so sure. I saw that a couple of the guys were signing autographs before the game, and I'm wearing an Adoree Jackson jersey, and he's standing right there autographing stuff. And I walk down there, and I'm like, this guy is like 23 years old, and like, you know, like I'm not gonna be a 40-year-old man taking off my jersey and be like, will you sign my shit, man? Like, it was,
hey,
cool,
buddy. Right? Yeah. Hey, kid, will you sign my shit? Because you're cool. Now, see, if I would never do that either. Now, John, on the other hand, yeah, I can see John licking Baker's balls to get a fucking shoestring from him.
No, John. You know? Yeah, John Drake would definitely be all over some Baker Mayfield. Actually, fuck, Baker Mayfield's awesome, man. I'm sure you guys are loving him.
Oh yeah, we do. I mean, it's great to have, but John is such a damn fan. It's like last night we were doing the podcast last night, and he's just on and on and on, and he's talking about, well, what if they win out, and what? And I'm like, dude, would you stop? You know, stop with the win out nonsense. Stop with the playoff talk. You know, be happy that we got four wins, and you know, we're gonna maybe get one more, and stop there. Stop reading more into it. If I'd have told you at the beginning of the year we're going to have five wins, you'd have been doing cartwheels.
Right.
Now you playoff berth? Shut up. They're not ready yet.
I don't know. It's a lot of fun to watch, though. They were actually on regular TV here the other day, and I watched the Bengals game, and you know, yeah. I loved. I even texted John the next day. I was like, when Hugh kind of went in for the hug, and Baker's like, nah, I'm good.
Yeah. Like, yeah, fuck you, pal.
Fuck you. It's too much, man.
Yeah.
Well, cool, man. Let's talk a little bit about your book here. I'm about seven chapters in, as we talked about a little bit earlier, and I love these books, man, because they're not, you know, with the Cause and Effect Motley Crue, and with this one, and even the Metallica, the Cause and Effect. You know, I love that where you kind of put where you were in life, and not, you know, you're a little bit older than me, so I kind of like put where I was in life, and all the sure. stuff going on and stuff. So it's not just a this is the record, this is who produced it, this is the engineer. Like, this is, like, life around the record, and I kind of like the what you right. do with these.
Thanks. You know, and that's kind of the thing is, I'm not a historian, and I don't want to be a historian. Mm-hmm. I just like to write is really why I do these books, is I like to write, and I do have a lot of knowledge about pretty much everything from that era, from the 80s and 90s. So for me, it's kind of fun to write these books and to do, you know, to try and make sense of these things, not only from the business side of the record coming out and what it did and the fans liking it or not, but looking back and saying, well, I was 16 years old when this came out, and this is what I was into, and this is why I like this, or this is why I didn't like this, or what have you. So, you know, doing these books, it's a lot of fun. And what's really been cool is that a lot of people have been hitting me back, really digging it, for the exact reason that you just said. They'll hit me back and they'll say, you know what, I had this experience. And then they tell me their story about when they got this record or that record. So it's really cool, you know, that it's reaching people, and that it's not just yeah, they went to the Bahamas to record and they were having a great time. You know, I think it's a fun read, and it's an easy read. And if you're a fan, or even if you're not a fan, I think you could still find something good in all of them.
I want to start off with the dedication. You dedicated it to your mom, and I've heard you, you dedicated it to a few people, but you dedicated it to your mom as one of them. And I've heard you talk about her, in the past on the CMS, on the Classic Metal Show. Talk a little bit about your relationship with her, and like what she kind of meant to you, because I know she took you to a lot of shows as a kid, and even to like Led Zeppelin and things like that.
Yeah. Yep. I, as a 9-year-old kid, I was at Led Zeppelin, which, you know, I didn't even know what I was seeing, but I knew it was loud and cool.
Right.
But my mom always, like, my dad had the worst taste ever in music. He was into like Boxcar Willie and Slim Whitman and, you know, just garbage like that. But my mom was always like the hip, cool mom. She was into like the Stones and the Beatles. And as, you know, as time went on, she grew up into it now. I mean, she's 70 years old now and she listens to rap and hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's listening to like T.I. and stuff. And I'm like, Jesus, mom, come on. You know, but she was always cool. And what was cool was she worked at a bank, and the biggest concert promoter here in town at the time was called Belkin Productions. And it's basically now been absorbed by Live Nation. But the guy that ran Belkin Productions used to bank with my mom, and he would come in once a week to do the banking for the company. And he would give my mom tickets and passes to everything. So as a kid, I went to shows and was backstage at shows and, you know, was meeting rock stars from the time I was a little kid, maybe 10, probably even younger than that. I mean, I remember being a little kid, 6, 7 years old, meeting Captain and Tennille and Harry Chapin and,
nice,
you know, different stuff that my mom took me to. And, but she was always really cool about taking me to the stuff that I was into too, you know, before I could even drive. You know, I met Twisted Sister and Dokken in 1984, and I was, I don't know, 13 years old, 14 years old, something like that. And, you know, that was a little kid, and here's my mom trudging me out to see Twisted Sister and then hanging out to see those freaks and get autographs, you know, and pictures and whatnot. So she really did teach me from a young age to appreciate music and to like a lot of different things. And I think it's where I got my sort of addiction, was because from the youngest age, I was really listening to it.
Does she read your stuff, and does she read the books, and does she, you know what you're doing with like the CMS stuff like that?
Yeah, she's well aware of who I am. I don't know that she's read all the music books. I just gave her a Priest book today. But I know she did not read the Motley Crue book. She read Call Me Chris. She read Little Victories. I would imagine she probably read the Metallica book. And as far as the CMS, she's aware of what I do, but she knows not to listen. You know, it's funny is that she has friends that listen, because, you know, when she worked at the bank, she had people that were younger than her that were, you know, her subordinates. And now they're, you know, now she's retired, but they're still doing what they're doing. And they're about my age. So she has quite a few friends that are my age that will tune into the CMS every once in a while. And she'll call me up every once in a while, and she'll be like, you know, Eric said that you were talking about this. What were you doing? And I'm like, Ma, just don't worry about it. You know? So yeah, she's definitely aware of what I do.
So has the fucking of the ham made it back to her yet?
You know, I think she knew, you know, I mean, I don't know that she knew that I actually stuck my dick in a ham, but, you know, it's funny that has taken off. You know, it's one of those stupid. I always tell too many things on the CMS,
right?
You know, I just let everything go, every weird thing I've ever done. And I'm a fucking weirdo. I'll be the first one to admit it. You know, I've done some weird and crazy shit. And, you know, that one, everybody seems to have grabbed onto. I guess it must be weirder than the other shit. But I don't know that she knows or didn't know. I didn't ask her. I didn't go out of my way to ask her. Put it that way. I mean, how do you approach your mom and say, hey, mom, what do you think about the fact I stuck my dick in a ham? Is that okay? You know, yeah, I think her only, if I did ask her, I think her only response would be, well, you threw it away, right? You know, right. I don't think she would question it. I think she would just make sure that I didn't let her serve it. You know?
Oh my God. And then you also start off the book with the, you know, talking about your high school baseball career and you know, your buddy that was the pitcher that turned you on to Judas Priest and things like that. So, I mean, that's kind of where I get at the, you know, it's also about your life, but it's also about Turbo.
Sure.
And you're kind of going into the baseball stuff. How real were the scholarship offers for your baseball career?
Well, they were real. I mean, I had a full ride offer to go to Arizona State, and I had a partial to go to University of Indiana. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were real. They were scouting me for 3 years. Wow. You know, trying to. I was a very good baseball player, and you know, it was one of those things that me and my dad did not see eye to eye on that type of stuff. And, you know, it was one of those that I wanted my freedom more than I wanted anything. And I knew, you know, in my head, I mean, I was a partier. I was drinking and snorting coke and smoking pot and sticking needles in my arm. And
in high school?
Oh yeah.
Christ.
I shot heroin. I was like 16, 17. And I was always, this is going to be a real shock here, but I was always the kid that would go to like the college parties because I used to sell weed every once in a while, or like always.
daily.
Yeah. So I had a friend that was in college at Kent State, which is right down the street from where I was living. And I would go to the parties with my friend Andy, and that was my place that I could sell all my weed. Was I could sell it to the college kids at the parties. Well, what would end up happening was I would start drinking or smoking pot or whatever I would be doing. And somebody would put something out on a table, you know, and they'd be like, oh, look at the little kid, won't even do a line of coke. And meanwhile, then somebody challenged me like that. I was like, okay, make that line 6 feet long and I'll do the whole thing, you know? And the same thing happened a couple of times with heroin. Somebody dared me to shoot. So I did. You know, not proud of it. I don't look at it like, oh, what a great move that was necessarily. But, you know, luckily for me, very luckily for me, I did heroin twice. And both times it made me sick, like puking sick. And I just never went back to it. I just was like, enough of that. I didn't feel very good. In fact, I felt very bad. So I was like, this is not the drug for me.
Man. Yeah, I'm glad I never touched that. You know, it's funny, all of the touring and being around musicians and things like that. I mean, I remember being around certain bands being on their tour buses and, you know, they're all doing lines of coke and shit. And I'm like, oh, fuck, I got to get out of here. You know, not get out of here, but I'm definitely not doing that. And, you know, so I've definitely been around it, but I'm glad I never actually tried it. Because I think my personality is the type of personality to have been like, I probably would have been a huge addict.
Sure. Well, I know I was a total pothead for a long time. And I stopped for 25 years, and I've just recently gone back to smoking it a little bit. Not a ton, not like before, but I love it. I love it, which is one of the reasons that I try not to do anything, you know, really for the most, I mean, I don't do any coke or any of that kind of shit anymore, but every once in a while I'll smoke a little pot. And it's like, even that, it's like, I could see it becoming a quick issue with me again. So it's like, I'll just avoid that. And Lord knows I drink like nobody's business. So, you know, for me personally, it's probably good that I don't add up any more vices than I already have.
Yeah. As square as it sounds, I think the reason I don't smoke weed all the time or at all, it's just because it's not legal. If it was legal or it's getting there, but as soon as it becomes legal, I'll probably become a recreational pot smoker. But at this point, you know, I'm just not really into, you know, any kind of stupid jail time over something silly.
Well, they don't really jail you unless you're doing a ton, unless you're moving it anymore. They get a ticket, but you don't want to, dude, if you're not missing it, then why do it?
Right.
You know, if you're not sitting around going, man, I just can't mellow out, I need a joint. If you're not doing that, then what's the purpose? You know, there's no real reason to do it unless you feel like you're missing something.
Yeah, I think I told you when I ordered the book that I was never the biggest Judas Priest fan. And I think I've been thinking about it and trying to figure out maybe why I wasn't the biggest Judas Priest fan. And I think it's just because when I got into metal, it was about 90, 91. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, that would have been Black Album, that would have been Countdown to Extinction, Seasons in the Abyss, you know, all that stuff, like the super, super heavy stuff. And I went super heavy, super quick, like right into Deicide and Cannibal Corpse and things like that. So, and Headbanger's Ball would play the Break in the Law video and stuff like that. And it just seems so tame, and it seems so like
old.
Yeah, it seemed old. It was like old metal. It was at the time. And so I just never really latched on to Judas Priest. But, you know, when you got into them, you know, listening to your passion about how, you know, it was kind of like the craziest stuff you ever heard at the time and stuff, and kind of, I guess, go into that a little bit and kind of how, like, when you got into it, how it was like life changing for you.
Sure. Well, I mean, if you think about that time, I got into them in like 84. And if you think about what else was going on at that time, there really wasn't a lot of extremely heavy music at that time. And if there was, you know, because everybody will always answers back of, well, you know, there were some bands. There was Anthrax and there was Metallica and there was Megadeth. Well, those three bands, you had to really know somebody that knew somebody to have heard of those bands. You know, it wasn't like now. Mm-hmm. There was no mandatory Metallica. There was no, you know, Megadeth. There, I mean, I was aware of Metallica because I was in high school radio and I went to CMJ festival and, or whatever the conference, mm-hmm. and they played. And that was like the first time ever I had heard anything like that. And I was like blown away by how heavy they were. But even with that, there was nobody else. You know, I wasn't aware that there was anybody else making music like that. I was aware of what was around me, and I'm, you know, I live in the Midwest in Ohio. So I was aware of what was going on the radio and on MTV. So it was all, you know, Motley Crue, Quiet Riot, Y&T, you know, those types of bands. Then in 84, you know, even like Zeppelin and stuff was still hugely popular. So 84 comes around and all of a sudden I hear Priest with these crazy vocals and this, you know, this big guitar sound and huge solos and big drums. And I was like, this is the greatest shit ever. You know, I was like, oh my God. And then, you know, I got my hands on like three or four albums really, really quickly, which I talk about in the book. Yeah. I stole them, but I got my hands on, you know, basically the pinnacle of their career all at once. So my initial indoctrination to Judas Priest was Screaming for Vengeance, Defenders of the Faith, British Steel, Point of Entry, which if add Painkiller, and that's really all you need for me personally, though that would be all I would have ever needed from Judas Priest. But those records were so good and so much heavier that, I mean, whether you think Judas Priest is heavy or not, if you listen to them next to Quiet Riot, they're certainly heavy.
Right.
And they're certainly heavy next to Y&T. So for me, it was like the heaviest thing I had discovered. And it was talented, you know, there. And I don't know how else to put it other than those guys were all major league talented. And it just blew me away. And I mean, even today, Judas Priest, my favorite bands of all time are Pantera 1, Metallica 2, Judas Priest 3. They are still right up there for me. And they've done a couple of clunker records, but, you know, overall, I'll listen to just about anything that they do.
All right. So with your books, you know, the Cause and Effect series, it's about, you know, albums that change the fans' perception of the bands or put a ripple mm-hmm. effect through the fans, you know, with the Motley 94 book and the Black Album book. And now this one, you kind of say in the book that your initial reaction to the album was you loved it and you thought that the people around you loved it also. You know, right. there was, it wasn't as hated as it's become. And then it's almost kind of come full circle because I still hear a lot of people kind of reflecting, you know, fondly of that album. So it's kind of was it a myth that kind of grew, or was it a true hatred for this album?
I guess it really just depends on who you ask. If for the fans that were, see, the Judas Priest's biggest problem, with at least with Turbo, was that the records before it were so good. I mean, Defenders of the Faith and Screaming for Vengeance, those two alone, those, I think most Judas Priest fans will say that those are two of the top three records in the Judas Priest catalog. Some will throw Painkiller in there. Some will throw British Steel in there, but most agree that those two records are like the pinnacle of that band. So you had that going for them going into this record. And then this was so different with the synth guitar sound and the, you know, the electronic drum beats and just a lot of different stuff. And all the songs were like love songs or relationship type songs, where Judas Priest was never really about that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for me as a 16-year-old kid, that was right. You know, I mean, dude, you remember when you were 16 years old, you're listening, not you necessarily, but most of the kids in school were listening to music that all sort of fit for a prom.
Right.
And here came Judas Priest making that kind of music, and they fit the time. And that's the part that everybody always forgets. People are so quick to hammer on Turbo, but yet they don't hammer on Ozzy for The Ultimate Sin, which is a hell of a lot softer than, you know, Diary of a Madman or Bark at the Moon or, you know, any of those records. But it was the same thing. They were selling out a little bit. For me at 16, it worked. But for those that were A, a little bit older, and B, were a little bit longer term Judas Priest fans, they hated it at the time. And I think if you ask those older curmudgeon guys, they'll still tell you that record stinks. But I do think that over time, people have come to find that it's really not as bad as they remember it. They just remember the one song, Turbo Lover, and it wasn't heavy, and most of them turned it off and didn't listen to it. To where now, if you play them Reckless or Locked In or something that they may not have really listened to back then, they'll be like, yeah, that's a pretty cool Priest song. What's it from? And then when they hear it's from Turbo, they're like, oh, okay, maybe it's not as bad as I thought.
I think the parallel with this is that the fact that they kind of came back around and they made heavier music again, so you can kind of forgive them for that middle of the career stuff. And that kind of goes along with, like, with Metallica, you know, coming out with Hardwired and even Death Magnetic, kind of going back a little bit to their heavier stuff. So you don't give them so much shit for Load and Reload as you maybe once did. But if they would have maybe stayed in that vein, you would have been like, that's where I gave up on them and that's where I stopped. But now you're like, you know, those really aren't that bad. But
right. And in Priest's case, and everybody forgets this, if they hadn't done Turbo, and then what I think is the worst album they ever did, which was Ram It Down right behind it, which was just bad. They just didn't have any ideas, and it's just too slick and trying to get soundtrack songs and everything else. Just not a good album. But if they didn't have those two crappy albums, then they wouldn't have been driven as hard as they were for the next two records to make the heaviest stuff of their career with Painkiller and then Jugulator once Ripper joined. So, you know, you can fault it, but I mean, again, it's weird because you can pick it out. If you pick any record out in a band's history, you can say something good or bad about it. But if you look at it over the course of their history, everything leads to everything else as a band grows and changes and develops. And in Priest's case, they produced a lot of good music as the result of the way people perceived Turbo and Ram It Down right after it.
I don't know how often you listen to Josta's show, you know, Jamie Josta, the Hatebreed's podcast, but, you know, he actually brings up Turbo a lot about about bands kind of taking a left turn and fans growing to love it. You know, he'll say that Hatebreed will play a festival with Judas Priest and he'll watch it, and every single person at the festival is seeing Turbo Lover along with Judas Priest now, you know, kind of a revisionist history kind of look at it.
Sure. No, I don't doubt that, dude. I mean, it's a fun, and that song is not one of my favorites on the record. So it's a cool song, but it's not the best. But it is a reflection of that whole album, you know, and that whole time. I mean, that whole time was about anthemic rock, and that's what Judas Priest was doing. They were doing the kind of thing where they wrote 9 songs that all could be, you can envision them singing on a stage and the crowd either singing back to them or pumping their fists or whatever. And that's what Turbo was. And maybe in today's world that doesn't play as well, but, you know, back in 1986, that was what was going on.
So you talk about your girlfriend at the time, Melanie, that, you know, you turn the album on, you're like, you're waiting for her to, you know, rip it out of your state-of-the-art tape deck, and and she never does, and she actually asks for a copy of it. At the time, were you more like, oh no, she likes it, or oh yeah, she likes it, this is fucking great, now we can be closer? Where were you at thinking there?
probably the oh no. I mean, you know, dude, it was one of those things, and it's a weird thing when you think about it. But for whatever reason, when I was younger, I did not want my girlfriends to be into the music that I was into at all. I was always like, this is my thing away from you. And I really was like, I used to play metal for her and she would hate it. She would hate like the, what was considered metal at the time, the Motley Crue and even stuff like AC/DC or whatnot. She'd be like, eh, you know, cause, and as a kid, I mean, she was always, as soon as I got my driver's license, I'm taking her to go and see, I don't know, the Romantics or Corey Hart or, you know, pick a cheese ball band, Prince, Madonna, whatever. You know, I went to all these shows with her, and then all of a sudden I was like, all right, well, I'm going to fuck with her with a little Judas Priest here. Put it on, and she's just like, all right, that's not too bad. Cool. I was like, wait a minute. What do you mean cool? It's not cool. It's Judas Priest. You're not supposed to like this. So, yeah, I think I wanted her to not like it as much as she did.
That's terrible. So was that before or after people were kind of starting to talk about that not being a very good Judas Priest album? And then that happens, and you're like, oh shit, maybe they are right.
I think it was all at the, you know, it was all in that same time, you know, it, for as well as I tell stories, making it sound like I videotaped everything. A lot of it is a little bit hazy, and I just kind of try to fill it in and put it in some sort of an order. It was just, there was just that whole time frame, that whole 3 or 4 months of, cause that record was out. Van Halen's 5150 was out, and that was obviously a very different record. You know, Ozzy Ultimate Sin was out. There was quite a few kind of turning point records that were all out at the same time. And people were loving the Ultimate Sin and people were loving the Van Halen, but they were not loving the Judas Priest. They were lukewarm to it. So then when this girl was into it that shouldn't have been into it, then I was like, uh-oh, what, maybe I'm reading this thing wrong or something. But never did change my opinion of it. It just was just one of those funny moments.
So kind of back in the mid 80s, we're talking, you know, your high school days, and that's the one thing that you know, looking back on metal and the rise of even like the quote-unquote hair metals, the Bon Jovis and the Motley Crues and stuff like that, the one thing that the popularity of those bands that a lot of people don't think about is the fact that, you know, when you went to high school, there were a lot of kids in your school that probably liked Bon Jovi, that liked Dokken, that liked, you know, even, you know, Poisons and things like that, like the 80s hair metal bands. If you go to a high school right now, you know, my kids are in high school and middle school, and you know, they all like the mumble rap and things like that. But the amount of kids that are into metal these days is probably pretty small. And sure, you know, where in the 80s, like, metal was the thing. You know, hard rock and metal, not necessarily like Metallica, but the you know, the full on radio metal, I guess you want to call it.
Yeah,
and that's a crazy thing to look back and see all the kids into, like, you know, just even like teenage girls into Dokken. It just still like blows my mind.
Yeah, I mean, dude, I mean, my almost every experience that I could think of, every first of that you want to think of as a, you know, as an adult that you want to remember as a kid, for me was surrounded by hard rock and heavy metal. First kisses, first blowjobs, first everything was all based, you know, I could tell him as quick. First kiss was listening to, actually, I don't remember that one, but First Blowjob was definitely in the parking lot at a Kiss concert, Kiss nice. And Black and Blue, and on the Asylum tour. You know, first sexual experience was also to Kiss, sadly. That's sad. But but I mean, all of that stuff was what was, that was, everybody was into it, or most everybody was into. There were in those early to mid 80s, there were two factions of people. There were the people that were into the hard rock and the metal. It probably started as light as like Journey or Foreigner and went up to not including Metallica, because there was a few that knew of Metallica, but not too many. but it was all that Motley and, you know, all the hair metal type stuff, really. And then the other half was the Madonna Prince crowd.
Right.
Everybody was into Madonna and Prince. And basically, it really was a hard divide there. I was into both because I'm just a musical freak, I guess. But for the most part, there were not very many people that were listening to Bon Jovi and Madonna, which is weird because if you listen to it now, it really doesn't sound that crazy different.
It's pretty much the same.
Yeah, but back then it was a huge difference. And, you know, and like, I guess the crossover guy was probably Prince, if you think about it, because he played some pretty heavy guitar on like Purple Rain.
Right.
And not on the song Purple Rain, the album with, you know, Let's Go Crazy. That's a pretty heavy guitar that and, he was, you know, playing.
Darling Nikki's got some double bass in it. So,
yeah, that's what I mean. There was some definite moments that kind of blurred the line. But back then, almost everybody was into it. And it was just about having fun anyway. And, dude, there was nothing cooler than going to party at the local McDonald's. And none of us had any money or anything. But, you know, we would sit out back and we would sneak a six-pack or a bottle out of our dad's cupboard and just sit there and drink and smoke a little weed and listen to these tunes full blast in the back of the parking lot. Nobody ever gave a shit, and it was great. Just some of the funnest times of my entire life.
Yeah, I'm sitting there trying to think, like, you know, my high school years were 93 to 97. So, I mean, like, my peers, I guess, you know, they were into, you know, Bush and Nirvana and
Collective Soul and that kind of.
Yeah, I mean, but it's still guitars. So, I mean, I'll give it that. You know, it's still like the you know, a lot of Sublime, you know, things like that. Right. And, you know, obviously I was listening to like Decapitated and things, you know, or Dismemberment, you know, shit like that. But, you know, so I still stuck out like a sore thumb with those guys. But yeah, I mean, there was still at least some guitars. And then, you know, you go to my kid's school now and you might see a Black Veil Brides shirt or something. But, you know, that's right, few and far between.
Yeah, now, I mean, what do the kids even have now? Greta Van Fleet?
I don't even know if kids like that. I think it's just like old dudes like it because it sounds like Zeppelin.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what the kids listen to rock-wise at all these days. I mean, I listen to a bunch of Screamo stuff, and I'm just
still,
like...
that shit's still 10 years old, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, that is true.
It's crazy.
We're getting old fast. I still look at Gage as a new band, and meanwhile, they're, what, 20?
Yeah, it's about that. Yeah, all that early 2000 stuff. You know, yeah. you and I both just had Trevor from Unearth on, and that's, you know, they started in what, 98. So I mean, that's, you know, 20 years of the, you know, 20 years of that band and shit. So that's crazy. But I was talking to Trevor of Unearth, and I think when I interviewed him a while back, kind of talked about, you know, his band and the Atreyu and a couple of those bands actually brought playing guitar back into style. You know, my era of Limp Bizkit and Korn, you know, kind of took away the guitar solo. And then those dudes came back with a vengeance. Avenged Sevenfold and all those guys came back with so much talent.
Yeah, they did. They definitely did. Dude, tell me it's not crazy when you hear old guys. And I consider myself an old guy. I mean, I'm 50.
Right.
And I think I am the oddball that still listens to new stuff, that still will find and listen to new stuff and try to find newer metal that I can enjoy. And I mean, so many people have just quit on it. They it drives me crazy. I mean, obviously I do the classic metal show, so
right,
you know, those people that listen, they want to hear their Dokken and Rat and Motley Crue, and that's cool. I like that stuff too, but it's like, to me, it's so damn shallow that you don't give, you know, newer stuff a chance. I mean, these guys will all, it is crazy to me when I talk about bands that I think are even old for now, and people say, oh, I don't listen to that new shit, like Machine Head or
right,
Fear Factory. I'm like, Fear Factory, they're what, 25 years old? That's, yeah, not new. That's old. That's the same old as your Dokken and your Motley Crue. You know, it's like, come on, you guys, grow a little bit. The reason you guys are so stuck and bored with your music is because you don't go and find new stuff. It's crazy.
seems like they don't go find new stuff. And then even when like a Dokken or Steven Piercy or whatnot put out a new album, it's just like, nah, I'll stick with the 80s stuff.
Yeah, I'll listen to Round and Round again because I haven't heard that 3 billion times.
I've definitely fallen into your era, you know, lately with Steven Piercy and Jakey Lee on the podcast, and sure. You know, I've been venturing into those 80s dudes, which is kind of funny because, you know, when we came up in music, like when I came up in playing in bands and stuff, and those guys started showing up around Nashville. You know, we were like, what the fuck is going on? You know, you would go to a show and the Nelson Twins would be there and you're like, why are you here?
Right.
Cause that would have been like 94, 95 when they all just moved to Nashville for some reason.
Sure. Well, and the thing is that those bands from the late 90s, early 2000s, they really didn't stick around. You know, there's not a plethora of those. Like, you know, these 80s bands, even if they had very little success, I'll throw a band, and I like this band called Junkyard, who probably don't even know, you know, but they're still around. And, you know, those bands from the 80s, if they had any semblance of success, they're still around and they can still put 200 people in a club somewhere and make a little money. Those bands, the Flybangers of the world or Bleed the Sky or whatever, I mean, where'd those guys go?
Right.
And they were solid enough bands, you know, but they just went away. They went nowhere.
Yeah, there's definitely a divide in some of those bands. You know, you've got bands like a Limp Bizkit that'll headline a festival still, but then you've got the smaller bands like POD's playing here next week, and I'm actually really curious to kind of see the crowd, if it's going to be a decent sized crowd or not, because I mean they were kind of one of the last few big MTV bands, so I wonder if that still carries any weight, you know, from all the success that they honestly had because of 9/11, which is crazy, right. but I kind of wonder how those guys will do.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. And it's always interesting to see when these guys, you know, try to come back. The one I'm the most interested to see is, I keep hearing a rumor that Aaron Lewis is going to put down the country guitar and do a Stained record and a tour.
Right.
And I will be very interested to see that, because he for a minute, Stained was everywhere.
Oh yeah.
I mean, Stained was a huge, huge band, but they went away at the right time. So I almost think that they might be the one of that era that's going to be able to come back and be as big or bigger, because they didn't stick around and do a bunch of garbage records. They just, you know, broke up, and, you know, one of the guys was in Newstead's band for a while. And obviously Aaron Lewis is now, you know, hillbilly Aaron Lewis doing his country thing. So I honestly would like to see what that's going to do. But other than that though, dude, I mean, what other bands are out there that came up in our era, in your era, I guess?
Well, I mean, you've got Slipknot, you've got Korn, you've got, you know, Limp Bizkit doing, but a lot of these bands did the smart thing and they went away and they didn't, continue to put out shit records. And so now when they come back, like a System of a Down, who I love, but yeah. I know that's not a lot, and it's not everyone's cup of tea, but they put out, you know, 4 or 5 albums, went away, created some sort of weird mystique, and then now that they come back, and now that they're, you know, they're headlining that whatever Rock on the Range is called now, and, you know, they're headlining, you know, giant arenas and stuff, you know, and they were, dude, I saw them in a strip club, you know, back in the day. So opening for Fear Factory. So it's crazy that they've come, you know, the bands do that part of it and go away and come back. And, you know, even, you know, your boy Vinnie Vincent, your girl Vinnie Vincent, you know, the hype that was around him, her coming back was crazy. Right. And had he stuck around, you know, there would be no interest in him.
Oh, dude, I mean, the proof is in the pudding in that one. All you gotta do is look to Bruce Kulick that came around after. Mm-hmm. He was in the band 15 years. Nobody gives a shit if he plays anywhere. And I'm not the guy. He just doesn't have any connection now.
Right. Yeah. He's been in Grand Funk Railroad, I think, for like 20 years now or something crazy. Right. And like nobody gives a shit.
Yeah, exactly. It is weird though. I am as a fan of a lot of that music that came out in especially the late 90s, like between like about 97 and about 2005, I liked an awful lot of that music. And almost all of those bands, unless they were very big selling bands, are gone.
Yeah.
You know, all of that mid-tier, or there's the occasional that sort of sticks around every now and again, put something out, but it's like fractured version of like Stuck Mojo.
Yeah.
I loved me Stuck Mojo, but what they're doing now is not Stuck Mojo.
You got no bones, no Stuck Mojo.
No bones and no Bud and no, you know, most of the guys are gone. All it is Rich. Rich and, you know, some guys.
Yeah. Rich and it's Frank. Like,
oh, yeah. And that's it. You know, it's like, how is that? You know, the last I looked, that was like the backing band of Fozzy.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah, Stuck Mojo is now Fozzy yeah. without Chris Jericho.
If Jericho decided to rap, he could call himself Stuck Mojo.
We kind of started all of this talking about, you know, those 80s bands that are touring again and, you know, drawing a crowd here and there. And, you know, Tom Kiefer's Cinderella is going out, and or Cinderella's Tom Kiefer, I guess, is how he's billing himself. You know, going out and actually pulling a crowd. And fuck, he hasn't put out an album since like 94, like an actual Cinderella album. And I think he did a Tom Kiefer right. album, but you know, he's still singing, you know, you don't know what you got till it's gone. And that stuff right. is back on the radio and stuff again. I mean, there was just that time period in the 90s where those guys couldn't get arrested. And now they're playing, you know, festivals like Rocklahoma and people sure. are coming out in droves to see them. I think we're kind of on the cusp of some of that, the late 90s bands kind of coming back around. You know, I'm going to give a shout out to my good friend Metal Mike here, Mike G, for what I'm about to say. But, you know, when I was in Primer 55, you know, we did the big stuff in 02. We came back and did like a quote unquote reunion in 07. Couldn't get arrested in 07. I mean, there were shows like, you guys actually talked about this on the CMS a while back about playing a show to nobody.
Sure.
It wasn't in Primer, but it was in another band, and it was the first show of the tour, and we got to Augusta, Georgia, and mm-hmm. we start, you know, we were the opening band on some local bill package, and we literally played to no one. The sound guy went, like, there was two rooms in the club, like a sports, mm-hmm. a sports bar side and a club side. Nobody in the club side. The sound guy went into the other room, and then the bartender went into the other room. Literally nobody was it there, and I just kind of looked over it. I mean, we just used it as a onstage practice at that point. But yeah, I'll never forget that. And you guys were talking about playing to nobody, and I've literally played a show to nobody.
Sure. Well, dude, I've seen two shows that were close, right. and both will surprise you because they're both names. The first one is a very big name, but it was before they were famous, so I guess it makes sense. But I saw Godsmack play to eight paid people, and none of those eight were there to see Godsmack. They were there to see the local opener, which was just another garbage band, you know, that had eight friends that showed right. up. And I would imagine by the end of the night, I don't know because I didn't even stick around, but by the end of the night, they probably were playing to nobody because it was before the first album came out, and I went and I just remembered that I had seen them. And then the other one, which this one probably surprises me more, even though they're not as big of a band as Godsmack, but I saw Voivod in 96, maybe
mm-hmm.
95, somewhere in there, play to, there could not have been 15 people in the room. And I was just, you know, I don't know if you're a fan of them or not. I'm not especially. It was one of those things back when I was writing for a local magazine that I was there to review. But I knew their name. I mean, I knew of Voivod. I knew that they had significant history. And seeing a band like that play to not only to 15 people, but they were playing, they would finish a song and it was just death.
Right.
I mean, no applause, or even worse, there'd be that one guy that'd be like, yeah, and that was you know, that was it. And I really felt bad for him. I was like, my God, you guys honestly played for nobody. Why did you even come? But you know, it's tough when bands have to do that. I wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah,
that's gotta suck. Hello, floor, welcome.
We went and saw Overkill in probably 95, I think. And it was the big club there. I think it held 1,200 people. And we were the third line of people back. We were the back of the room. So there had to have been, 40 people there. And it was rough. But I mean, that's one of those bands now that'll come through and they'll pack out a club. So it's crazy how that shit, goes in cycles. And another, when I was on tour in Primer in 07, we were having people coming out that had never seen the band. They weren't big crowds. They'd be like 30 people at a show. Those 30 people knew every word to every song. Sure. So it was so weird, like trying to do that whole, like, if it's 5,000 or 5,000 thing, that's not a real thing. Like, that's, right. You play differently for 2,500 than 5,000. Like, I don't care.
Sure.
But,
it happens to everybody, man. I mean, this one will probably shock you. There's a venue here. It's the outdoor venue here. It's called Blossom Music Center. Mm-hmm. It seats 18,000 people. And one year, and it was Fear of the Dark, 91, 92, or even earlier, I don't remember, for Iron Maiden. And I saw Iron Maiden with Testament opening.
Wow.
And they had to just open up. There were so few people there that they had to just open up the pavilion area to let everybody come down, because there was probably like 400 people at this 18,000 seater.
Wow.
And it wasn't bad weather or anything. It just was no one cared. Iron Maiden was on a bad record. Testament was not a good draw. And for whatever reason, they didn't just cancel the show, but they did. I saw it. They played for like 400 people and an 18,000 seater. It was really sad.
And that's just when you like get off stage and you just start contemplating life. You're like, fuck this.
But look at it now. Now Iron Maiden is selling out every venue they play, whether it's 20,000 or 60,000 people, and they're selling tickets for, $200 a ticket. So I guess they did their time, so now they're reaping the benefit, right?
Right. Oh, and all this came back around to was a lot of those bands that were kind of in our area, our era, coming back around and being able to play. Doing this show, I get messages all the time like, dude, I loved Primer back in the day. You guys need to come back. You guys need to do this. And obviously, with our singer passing away, that kind of makes it a little bit tougher. But But, even when he passed away, like the outpouring of, the metal websites actually, picked up on all of that and stuff. And, people were talking about, oh, man, I still love Banging Loose and all this other shit. So it's on that cusp of, I think, a lot of stuff, kind of all those 20th anniversary tours are going to start popping back up. And, people giving a shit about Taproot again, things like that. Sure. So
I just hope that when it does finally rear its head, that people actually support it.
Yeah.
Because it's a thing for everybody on Blabbermouth to say, man, if these guys ever got back together, I'd be the first one there. And then when they do, nobody shows up. It's like, yeah, I'll just watch it on YouTube instead.
Well, I mean, I'm dealing with that now too. It's like, fuck yeah, this tour's coming through town. Oh shit, that's on a day that I have my son. Fuck, and it's like, that's 90% of fans right there. Like, that's... It's awesome, dude, until you realize life is in the way.
Dude, it's real life. On Monday, I was supposed to go see Hailstorm,
mm-hmm.
and it was like snowing. So, and I just was like, I think I'll just stay home. I had already bought tickets even. I just was like, I'm not going to bother with that. It's cold. The parking is shitty down there. I'll just stay home.
Right.
I'll watch it on YouTube. Good enough.
It'll be up tomorrow.
Well, yeah. And honestly, I watched my timeline because I had a bunch of friends that were there, and I just watched their videos. I was like, okay, I guess I didn't miss much.
That's so crazy.
It's the nature of the world today, man.
There's a dude here in town that he pretty much films every show, and from what I can tell, he has a pretty good camera, and so pretty much any show that you miss, you can go to his YouTube channel, and it's high quality, video. It's not cell phone quality video. He does a good job. And, right. Anything you miss, you can find here. Or if you want to go back and like, did that really happen at that Sebastian Bach show I went to the other day? You can easily find it. And it's crazy how people complain about, that's another thing. People complain all the time about everyone having their phones up. But as soon as somebody falls over or a prop falls on Marilyn Manson or something happens, like, where's the cell phone footage? Where's the cell phone footage? You know, like, it's such a double standard when it comes to that.
It really is. I will admit, it is somewhat annoying.
Yeah,
I've been going to quite a few concerts lately, and I take some video. I mean, I really don't care, but I do try to be respectful. Like, I don't. What drives me crazy is when guys hold the shit up over their head,
right?
To where you're 100% blocking somebody from seeing, and you know as well as I do, when they do that, where do your eyes go? They go to their camera instead of to the stage. It's just like a reflex, and it is annoying when people do that. You know, everybody could grab a. You can grab a video by just holding your camera kind of like face high so that the only person whose view it's blocking is your own. But people don't. They're disrespectful with it. Or like you said, some people will shoot a whole show. And it's like, all right, you know, I'm all for, all right, this is my favorite tune. Let me shoot 30 seconds of this or a minute of this or whatever. But man, if you're sitting there for 90 minutes just shooting,
right?
You know what? Photo pass, set up a tripod and the board and get a good sound at least.
We were at the Colts game we were talking about earlier, and when I'm at home, we have the DirecTV Sunday ticket, or not, we have Sunday ticket, but it's the streaming version they have now. So it's
right.
So it's a couple, it's about probably 10-12 seconds behind the actual feed. So if it's the end of the game and like some shit's about to go down, I'll turn my phone off because I'll start getting texts like, what the fuck was that? You know, what's going on here? Can you believe that just happened? You know? And so I've had to literally turn my phone off so it doesn't ruin the experience. And when we went to the Colts game, I was literally watching the game live in front of my own eyes. And if a play was about to happen and my phone started to go off, I was still thinking that they were about to ruin something, even though I was literally watching it live. It was such a weird like thing I had to get over. It was so bizarre.
Okay. Wow. I mean, it's insane that it works like that, man. But it is, you we're so trained to our phones now. We can't really, you can't pull away from it. And even if it's somebody else's phone, you still take a look at it.
Oh, right. Yeah, like, they, you know, somebody else has their Facebook open, and you're like, oh, I wonder what's going on in their feed.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you don't know one person on their feed.
Right. I don't know one person on my feed anymore. Actually, the other day, I posted something about the Titans, which I'm used to, you know, my circle of friends will post like, oh, I can't believe that happened and blah, blah, blah. Like, if you post about the Browns and like, I have so many people that I know through the show now that are fans of other teams, I post something about the Titans and then I just get berated with, you should be a Steelers fan, or you should do this, or you should do that. You guys suck. And I just started deleting people. I was like, I don't have time for this. I was like, I don't know you. Like, I don't have to hear your nonsense.
Right. Well, it's gotten to the point for me where I have been on this mass purge of people now. I'm really getting rid of, I'm trying to get rid of social media, in general, because it's just a soul suck. It really is. It just sucks your soul out.
Right.
But I have pages for all my stuff. I have pages for the books. I have pages for the show. I have pages for everything. So I've at this point now, I think I'm down to like 500 or 600 people when I was at 5,000. Purged 4,000 people. and with each passing day, I purge somebody else. You know, it's like I look at my timeline, and if they're talking politics, that's an immediate, you know, at a minimum, it's an immediate, unfollow. What do you call it? Unfollow. Yeah. And if they start messaging me about it, it's like, you're out of here. You know, and I just get rid of them. And really, because dude, let's face it, in today's world, I mean, social media wise, what do you really have that are your friends that you give a shit if they contact you or not? 30, 20?
Something like that. Yeah. It's gotta be really low.
Yeah, it's not 5,000, that's for sure. So, you know, for me, I'm so sick of it, and social media is such a hassle, and it is such a such a easy way to get yourself in trouble as well. So for me, it's like, all right, I'll just get rid of it. You know, I'm about done with it these days.
I do like the, I like opening up my app and, you know, checking out. I mean, it's a good place to find out all the quick, you know, metal news. And I have Blabbermouth and the PRP and a few other sites kind of, I guess, starred or whatever. So they're always first in my feed to just kind of, you know, keep up with that and keep up with the football stuff. And yeah,
sure.
But yeah, once I start seeing stuff from people, I'm like, I have no idea who this is. And
yeah,
wow, you complain. Dude, I'm like, you complain a lot. I'm out.
Dude, that's when I started the purge. When I was building my little pinball place. I was living half my time in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And when I would get home at the end of the day, I was like, well, let me see what's going on back at home,
right?
Which would be, you know, here in Ohio. And I would look in my news feed. I didn't know anything. I was like, all right, who's Joe? Who's Jill? Why do I care that they had a baby? You know, and why do I care what they're eating?
Right.
You know, who are these people? So then I'm start unfollow. Mm-hmm. I just decided, you know what? I'm done with this. Unfollowed. I went through, and if it was somebody I had not had a beer with or had a conversation with in the last 2 to 3 years, I'd just gone, you know, because look, and I know people probably look at that, and like if you did that as well, same thing of, oh, you're getting full of yourself, aren't you? Well, no, it's just, you know what? If, you know, I get woken up in the middle of the night from people constantly with my messenger going, because I never turn my phone off. And the stupid Facebook messenger will go off at 3:45 in the morning saying, dude, you guys were so funny when you talked about blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It's like, just go to bed. I'm trying to sleep here.
Right.
You know, I appreciate that you like the show, but post it on the show page. Don't post it here. Don't message me.
I'm gonna start setting alarm just to wake up the middle of the night and be like, dude, bro. You'll
find yourself followed in a hurry, my friend.
I have all of your cell phone numbers, so I'm good on that one. Well, man, it's been an hour, so let's wrap this one up with you know, where do they find the book and all that fun stuff.
Sure. Well, it's always available at my website, which is chrisaikenbooks.com. It's on amazon.com, Barnes and Noble. The audio book is only available right now at my website at chrisaikenbooks.com. The audio book does come with about an hour and a half of some extra stuff. An interview I did with KK Downing recently, and a nice discussion with Bob Nalbandian, the documentarian that does all those Inside Metal videos, you know, just talking about Judas Priest Turbo.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I think it's a good read. It's a good listen. And, you know, whether you like the album or you hated it, if you were around when it came out, you'll probably find something that you'll either love or disagree mightily with me on. So it's a good listen.
Did you get around to the interview with Don Dokken?
No.
Okay.
I messaged him, and then he was like, yeah, we can do it. Then it just didn't happen. Wasn't his fault necessarily. It was just, I wanted to because he toured with them on that tour, but it didn't happen. And then, you know, he and Neely were off, I don't know, shooting turkeys, having Thanksgiving or whatever. So they were doing their thing.
Where was your invite on that Don Dokken Thanksgiving, you know?
I would never get invited to that stuff. Dude, I would never. You know why? Because I never travel. Dokken has played here like 10 minutes from my house, and I didn't go once recently. You know, and it's no slap on them. I like them, and I certainly am friendly with all the guys in the band. It's just, you know, I'm not the guy that needs to see the same band 100 times. And I don't know about you, but I'm not always comfortable with the whole backstage thing. I don't like hanging out on, first of all, I don't like hanging out on the side stage to watch a show. That just always sounds like ass. And I'd rather be out front. And truth be told, I'm not so enamored to hang out. I like doing interviews where I can really take 15 or 20 or 30 just quality minutes, and I can focus on the stuff that I want to know. And you can't always do that with, you know, when you're hanging out backstage and you know, you start having a conversation and then some girl comes in to get her tits signed, or some dude with his guitar, or they got to go and do a sound check, or they need to take their order for food, or, I mean, you know, dude, you've been backstage a million times. It's not this fun, super fun thing that everybody thinks it is. It's not like you're walking back into this debauchery haven.
Right.
Instead, it's a lot of standing around and a lot of sitting around and a lot of half stories. You know, that's what I've always found. I don't know if you've had the same experience, but it seems like every time I go, somebody starts telling me something and then they get pulled away and I never figure out how the story ended.
The last time I was backstage was that Gene Hoglan interview I did. He actually took us like to the Testament dressing room, and we were sitting there, and this dude walks in about halfway through the interview, and he's like fiddling around with something, and he's got a beanie on, some headphones on, and he looks familiar, and I'm like talking to Gene. I look over, and it finally hits me that it's Alex Skolnick, but his hair is all up in a beanie, and right. You know, I'm like, oh shit, it's Alex Skolnick. But I couldn't really say anything because I was mid-interview. But yeah, right. that was always that. I just remember like almost basically having a brain fart and stumbling over my words because I'm like in the room with Alex Skolnick.
Sure, dude, it happens, man. It's always kind of weird, you know. And then you don't want to do anything that's crazy or nothing, or say the wrong thing or whatever and get booted out, or you know. Dude, I'm telling you, one of the weirdest things ever was, I don't know if I've ever told you this story or not, but So I have a friend named Jeff. He's a black guy, and he's a huge Pantera fan.
Okay.
So I took him to the Ozfest one of the years that Superjoint was playing, and Superjoint played, and this is back when it was fucked up, Phil. You know, when he was just a mess.
Yeah.
And I've known Phil forever. So I had passes to go and hang out and do an interview with Phil after Superjoint played. So Superjoint plays, we go back, we get on the bus, and it's me, Phil, Kate, and my friend Jeff. So we do this interview. We do like 30, 40 minutes, and it's one of the tougher interviews because Philip was just really slow. You know, he was just, well, I don't know. You know, he was that kind of slow.
Right.
And so we finished the interview. And this was a long time ago, obviously. So I'm literally packing up my gear because that was back when I used to have to carry like a little suitcase worth of gear to do an interview, like a tape recording interview. So I'm packing up my shit. And Phil looks at my friend Jeff and he goes, so... you're a black man, aren't you? and Jeff looked at me and I looked at him and he goes, yeah, I am. And he goes, let me tell you something about being a black man.
Okay. I'm scared where this is going.
It didn't go anywhere after that, but it was just the most, I mean, he was just talking about, you know, people should take, and Philip is not, for what everybody thinks, he does not come off like a racist if you actually speak to him,
right?
If you just chat with him, but he's not afraid of words either, so he's not afraid to start something that might start feeling uncomfortable and then take it to somewhere that's perfectly fine. And that was where he went into this conversation, went into something about you know, people should take self-pride and it shouldn't be about anything other than self pride. But the way he started it with the "you're a" and talking all slow and stuff, I was like, "You're a black man, aren't you?" It's like, and believe me when I tell you, with my friend Jeff, there's no way you're mistaking him as anything but a black
man. Right.
You know, I mean, he's not like Billy D. Williams light skinned. He's a black man, and it's like, dude, what are you doing? I didn't even know what to say. I just sat there like, all right, let's see where this goes.
Well, let's end this off with a song off of Turbo, man. What do you want to play?
Let's go with Private Property.
Very cool, Chris. Well, man, thanks for taking the time as always, and make sure to check out Chris on the Classic Metal Show.
Yep.
Benton Deicide, and you're listening to Talk to Me.
All right, huge thank you to Chris Aiken of the Classic Metal Show. Make sure you're checking him out weekly, Saturday nights. I believe it's 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, classicmetalshow.com for the live show, or you can check out snippets of the show throughout the week. Just search out your favorite podcast app, The Classic Metal Show. So much good stuff and good times over there. So once again, thank you to Chris Aiken. Thank you to Scott Bowling. And so for the Talk to Me podcast, I am Joshua Toomey, and I will talk to you guys next Thursday.